Well, I'm already stuck. Right, never mind, I'll start over. Right.
This podcast is a product of two students at the University of Barcelona. Though we try to ensure all the information we share is based on peer-reviewed empirical research, we may have let one or two things slip through. We urge the listener to listen with a healthy dose of critical thinking, but far more importantly, a big smile on their face.
Hello everyone to what is officially my first ever podcast. Luckily for me, I don't have to do it alone because I have the incredibly gifted neuroscience student and my dear friend Esther with me to help me get through it.
Hi everybody.
And we're going to be talking all about the flow state today and specifically what it means to athletes. But first I thought I'd ask you how you're doing.
I'm doing very well, thank you. How are you?
I am very good. The Olympics have started. Have you been watching?
Yes, of course. Yeah. I'm so excited about it.
Very excited about the Olympics, and we'll probably mention that later in the in the podcast. So I guess we'll just start.
Yeah.
So flow state, tell me, what do you know about the flow state?
So I've read a book from written by Mihai Cheeks and Mihai. We're just going to call him Cheeky. You know, an easier, simple name, shorter as well. He wrote a very influential book called Flow, The Psychology of Optimal Experience. And like this guy turns out to be super into this world, and he dedicated his life to search this, you know, flow state, which is super interesting. And he's written several books on the topic. So yeah, flow state is a state of heightened focus and immersion in an activity. And flow can come from anything that is your favorite and frequent activity. Let's say it can be gardening or eating or listening to music or generally whatever. And it is indeed seems to be very beneficial in a lot of fields in our lives.
So the flow state, people call it in the zone as well. It's something you hear athletes talk about quite a lot. And why do you think it's such an aim for athletes to get in the zone or to find this flow state?
Because like flow state is about your peak performance. So you are just at your top, your best that you've ever been before. And it's not really a state that you can force. So being in the state, the zone or in the flow state, I think it's a very privileged thing to have.
Right. And then have you ever experience it? Can you recall a moment where you were in a flow state?
Yeah, I think once or twice. So I'm doing short distance athletics.
Right, so I have to tell the listeners here that, you know, Esther, apart from being a neuroscience student, is also an athlete at a far more reasonable level than I am.
That's
so
not true.
This question actually means something to her. So flow state. What was it like to be in a flow state?
It was great. Yeah, I felt like I can do anything. I felt like I have a superpower or something, you know, that like all the obstacles I can take with ease. And I was very focused. Nothing really bothered me, external or internal. You know, time kind of flown away. And I didn't even realize, you know, what's going on besides on focusing on running technically.
Right, so this was, what distance was this?
It was a 400 race.
A 400 meter race is usually run in just under a minute.
So do you think the duration of such an event has to do with that necessarily?
Could be. I didn't experience it. Probably I didn't experience it from start to finish, to be fair. It was from like 200 meter to the finish line. That's where you get usually more tired, and then you need, you know, more focus and energy to be able to finish in a good manner. I think it's very individual how long it lasts for people. Also depends on your sport or kind of, you know, whatever your activity you're doing, because like in movies you the artists are portrayed as, you know, being in a flow state for hours or days working on a project. So yeah, maybe the duration for me has something to do with actually finishing the race.
perhaps. Well, it sounds like, you know, there's plenty to talk about. We're gonna get into the real athletes in flow state later, but I think first we might need to get a bit deeper into what getting in the zone or in the flow state actually is.
Yeah.
And Chicky, as we're gonna call him, and I'm not gonna even attempt to say his name. He's been doing a lot of work on this throughout his life, multiple books. Every paper that is about the flow state, you'll find his name in. And you've read it.
Yes, yeah, I did read the book, one of the books regarding to flow state. It was a good book, really interesting. He didn't really talk about, you know, sports-related performance. It was rather like finding the meaning of life and happiness through flow state as such. But it was still very interesting.
Very good. Well, let's do it. Let's get into it. From the corners of the world they come, the bravest and the best, to write the names of history, to face the final test. So the flow state, I think it's a good idea to maybe start with our normal lives, our daily lives. Not all of us are high performance athletes, and in the book, Chicky talks about this most of the time, really. Can you give maybe an example of being in the flow in our daily life?
Yeah, so he gave an example of a factory worker, you know, and he said it's a very kind of monotonous job to do.
Yes.
in general. And then he said that, like, if a factory worker set a kind of goal, you know, like, I don't know, packaging 100 mini muffins a day, and then for the next day he had 120 set, then he can get into a flow state just by focusing on this goal and kind of, you know, close everything else out and just, you know, do this job because it's very, you know, monotonous. It's kind of easy to get into the flow state.
Right. So actually, maybe I wouldn't necessarily call it boring side of
but
the repetitiveness,
yes,
of it could induce a flow
state.
Yeah,
definitely. And like, it's something that the factory worker, you know, does every day. So it's not like super challenging. But if he sets a goal to himself, like, oh yes, I want to do 140 instead of 120, that's already makes it less boring and more challenging. So you also have the challenge part that makes you motivated to do so.
Right. So I'm already hearing a couple of, I think, important words talking about, you know, goal setting, aims, talking about motivation.
Yeah.
Skill. Why don't we really go deep into what flow is? Can you talk a bit about that?
So flow is, it's kind of a mindset, and it involves a lot of things that I explain in my running example. So you have to focus entirely on the task. It has to be kind of like, you know, an active activity that you do, not like a passive, like watching TV or something. You have to get involved in what you're doing. You are at your, you know, peak abilities, your loose sense of time and space as well. You feel able to control whatever you're doing. So it seems like a very happy and sort of a very good state to be in.
Absolutely, it sounds even quite ecstatic
yes,
at some point. And
yeah,
you, if I can make a jump real quick to athletes that, you know, we see on telly, you often see athletes that describe themselves as being in the flow, come out of a race or a match quite euphoric, quite ecstatic. So I've been reading up on flow states, of course, as preparation for this podcast. And I came across many papers describing certain dimensions, nine in total. Maybe it's a good idea to go past all of them and go into a bit more detail with every one of them. For starters, for example, the challenge skill balance is often named. Can you explain what that might mean?
Yeah, so I'm just gonna connect it to the example with the factory worker that you have to have, certain skills to be able to, you know, package mini muffins or, you know, whatever. And then it has to be challenging enough for you, because, you know, if you have more skills than the challenge itself, then you're not going to be motivated. Also, if it's too challenging and you don't have the skills, you're also not going to be motivated to do this task. So, you know, you have to have the right balance.
Right. So I think this, for those very interested and very enthusiastic to this podcast, if you do have a pen and paper by hand, you know, what you can do is... Because this is what you often see in papers. It's a visualization of a graph where you got skill and challenge set out against each other. And, you know, you have the opposite of flow state, which is often called apathy, in the low skill, low challenge zone. But then in the high skill, high challenge zone, you will find the flow state.
Yeah, exactly.
So, for example... A rugby player that was part of a research into this described it as that the extreme challenge of a World Cup final was very imminent. They knew that they had this challenge coming up. But that being said, they didn't approach it as a major hurdle. They know they could do it. And I think that connects nicely with what you just said about the high skill and high challenge being needed.
Yeah, otherwise if it's, you know, too big of a challenge, you just get anxious.
Exactly. And I suppose we all sort of know this in a weird way from our daily life. You know, you don't want to be doing stuff you find rather boring because you're too good at it. But also massive challenges without any skills is always a tricky one, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right, so how about the next dimension?
So the next one is action and awareness merge. Do you wanna tell what it is, Lars? I'm
sure you know. Yes, of course. So action and awareness merging means that the involvement in the activity is so deep that there is kind of a feeling of automaticity about the actions. For example, an athlete has described it as you're so absorbed in what you're doing, you're not really aware of what is happening around you. Another athlete has described it as you don't feel like you're going too hard or too slow, you just flow. And then there it is again, that's also the, you know, the untouchable thing about it. You can't hear yourself breathe, and it's not laboring is also mentioned. And I think it's one of the more maybe noticeable things about being in a flow, the fact that you are not really distracted by anything.
Yeah, I think it's very important to just, because like sometimes you cannot really control the outside world. And sometimes, I don't know, for personal experience, it's really difficult to, you know, close out everything that happens in your environment.
Absolutely, it's something, you know, athletes train on, training very much as well. But it sounds like it sort of happens to you, perhaps, the flow state.
Yeah, you cannot control it. It just, you know, it's there.
it's magnificent, is what it is.
I know.
Is what it is. What about clear goal setting? We mentioned it before, very shortly, in your factory worker example.
Yeah.
Is it something, I mean, clear goals is it's quite an obvious
thing. Yeah, I think so
thing.
Too.
It doesn't need that much explanation, but is it something that you have experienced too in your training regime, for example?
Yeah, I mean, of course, you have to set clear goals before you start training, otherwise it's kind of pointless, you know, to train for something that you don't even know. And then if you don't have goals, you kind of get unmotivated after a while as well. So yeah, definitely having goals, working towards them, it also helps to have like certain level of challenge and helps you to develop the exact skills that you need to, you know, reach that goal.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose in certain match scenarios, people might recognize this. For example, before you hit the ball, you know it's going in. This is one of the many things that you hear all the time, and you go, how is it possible? And this could relate to this clear goal. You know what the ball is supposed to do, and when you hit that sweet spot, you know it's going to go in. It's a magnificent feeling.
Yeah, and then of course for clear goals and to reach them, we need a kind of feedback, right?
Right,
so,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Feedback is very important, and you know, you must have had this before where you were training hard or doing something, maybe it did a bit different to see how it felt, or you know what it would do for you, and you hear a coach or a trainer going shouting whatever, very unsupportive, very, you know, non-instructive feedback. It doesn't help, does it?
No, not at all. No, I don't know. I do need clear feedback, even though, you know, even if it's not like a good feedback or not a good comment because you did screw up, something that happens when you train. But it's still a feedback, and it helps you to work towards your goals and, you know, help to improve your skills in general. And then I'm going to tap into coaching a little bit, that coaches are also very important in reaching, you know, flow state with an athlete, especially because they give you feedback, and then you need that to kind of get into this state.
Right, and I imagine for athletics, this could be actually a problem sometimes because the coach is relatively far away from the athlete during the race.
Oh, I don't mind that though.
You don't mind that? Well, I think that could also lead into what does feedback mean, you know, because we're talking about feedback from a coach, but feedback could also mean sensory feedback.
Yeah,
it could also mean how do your feet feel on the track.
That's true.
And, you know, for athletes that work with, I don't know, javelins or darts even, you want that immediate response so you can adjust your behavior correctly, don't you?
Yeah, that's true. Well, so I don't really use anything like that because I'm a track athlete. And then for coaches, I think feedback is more important during training session, not during race. Like obviously after, but not during when you run. But yeah, like have your, I don't know, shoes touch the track. That's also a good feedback. And then that's, you know, an immediate response.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, we'll go into that a bit later, I think, but...
Lars made somewhat of a wrongful presumption here. We will not discuss bottom-up information processing further. So please pay extra attention in the next few seconds. Or grab a quick snack. That's fine too.
It's about what we call bottom-up information.
Yeah.
It's about information that is from your surroundings and you take it in. We call that bottom-up in neuroscience or neuropsychology. And it's supposed to play a great part in this reaching of the flow state.
Yeah.
So we'll talk about that a bit later.
We won't.
What I like to talk about as well is concentration, because this is a term that many people know.
Mm.
We all have some idea of what
yes.
it means. We also have some idea of how to achieve it. Some, you know, drink a lot of coffee to achieve it. Others do meditating. There's many ways, but it's unequivocally connected to flow state.
Yeah, that's true. And then you need to concentrate on a task that you're doing, not on anything else, but on the task. And then you have to kind of close everything else out and just, you know, focus on that one thing to be able to reach the flow state. And I think it works with like studying as well. Kind of like, for example, music helps me, you know, if I have a chill music, you know, with a headphones on, then I can just focus on whatever I do. But if you, I don't know, sit in a busy library or somewhere or coffee, you know, that's kind of difficult because people chat around you and stuff.
Absolutely. And I suppose the main difference with the sporting world is that you can't often influence the environment that much.
Yeah,
and if you don't like other athletes, well, they will be there usually, don't they? And with studying, at least you can adapt yourself to a situation where you feel like your concentration is highest.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, habituation and adapting to the environment is especially important in Winter Olympics, you know?
Absolutely, absolutely. Because as a runner, the track is usually the same, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
But as a skier, it differs every now and then. In fact, it was only postponed yesterday because of wind.
Yeah, that's correct, yeah.
And that's something you have to be able to cope with as well, of course, as an athlete.
Yeah, I mean, imagine like your race starts in 10 minutes and then you are kind of in the flow state, you are like very vibrant and you're focused. And then they said like, oh, sorry, it's, you know, delayed by 2 hours because of the wind. And then you have to put yourself through again this, you know, state of mind. It must be very difficult.
It must be very difficult. And I suppose it can mean the difference between, you know, a medal or nothing at all.
Yeah.
So it's not only very difficult, it's also highly rewarded if it goes right. What I think is also very interesting about concentration is that we don't actually know that much about concentration. We don't actually know that well what it is that makes us focused or makes us do things well.
I know, sometimes it's very different, like, because I have a playlist for running and sometimes it doesn't work. I have like mental cues to kind of be in that flow state or, you know, in that very focused state, but it doesn't work all the time. And I don't know why.
I think that's already quite interesting, because if I can speak for myself, I think all the times I have been in the flow state, and as I've mentioned, I'm not an athlete of any kind. So it kind of happened by accident, which I think will, you know, be the case for a lot of listeners. You don't really prepare for it. And of course, the big difference with athletes is that they try to aim for this to happen at a certain time. Sometimes being in preparation for this for years, the pressure itself can be very interruptive of this process, I can imagine. So what about control? Because it's another word that I see a lot happening in books about this, research about this, even rather mainstream media, you know, away from the scientific journals. You see the fact that control, being in control, feeling in control, words like positive thoughts is something you hear a lot.
Yeah.
What does that do, and why is it paradoxical as well in a flow state?
So what I think it means is that you can kind of control your own actions. I mean, you can control a lot of things when you're racing or you're doing whatever, but I think it's about trying to control what you can in general. So like, I don't know, creating like mental cues that could trigger flow state, you know, choosing an environment, like for example, studying, you can choose where you want to study, if you're going to go to a busy library or not. Of course, for racing, it's not really the case. But yeah, it's just really about controlling yourself, your thoughts, you know, kind of not letting anything negative or disturbing getting into your head before, you know, racing at least. It happens to me a lot, like anxious thoughts do come in sometimes, and those don't help
and
reaching full state.
It's about recognizing those thoughts.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, sometimes you're able to stop them, but sometimes you're not.
Yeah, yeah. Or well, I mean, again, this is probably we all recognize. But what I find very interesting about this, especially in you know, being in the zone or the flow state, is that it's quite paradoxical, because the feeling of being in control is good, but then what you hear a lot from the descriptions given by athletes is that it felt like it was happening naturally, without a conscious effort. So that sort of is in contrast with the being in control.
Does
the book describe this at all, or can you help you help us understand this a bit more, maybe?
So the book doesn't really, like this book at least, doesn't really describe this paradox. It do talk about the flow of thoughts that I mentioned, that you kind of can control your thoughts. But I think what happens in this case, you kind of like just lose, it's not really a conscious process flow. So this is why it feels so natural, because it's not really conscious. And that's also our next point that, you know, our next dimension, the loss of self-consciousness.
Right. Well, let's immediately go on to that. And I think, well done, kudos you for are. That for that bridge. That was lovely. That was amazing. So the loss of self-consciousness. Now, shortly, I'll give a short explanation, as at least I understood it. It's that the concern for the self, as it said, disappears, and the person or the athlete becomes one with the activity, or you know, with the environment. For example, I read this thing about a cyclist who mentioned that, you know, when you're not working alone on a bike anymore, you're working with the bike, and it doesn't even seem like you're sitting on the bike. It feels like you're one piece of machinery working together. I think that's a great example, but you know, in with a bike, that makes maybe a bit more sense. But how would you, you know, define loss of self-consciousness when you're, for example, running or swimming?
I don't know. It's difficult because, you know, you're not conscious. So, you know, whenever I'm being asked about this, like, I don't know, it happened and it felt super good, but I can't really tell because I don't know what was going on my mind. I just felt like, oh, it's great.
Yeah, and I think actually that's a good point to make at this at this point, that you know, the research on this is very early on. There's not a lot known about this. Obviously, it's a hard thing to investigate because it's such a personal experience. You don't often know it's going to happen. So most of the research or most of the knowledge we have on this is anecdotal. And I think especially with this domain or this dimension, the loss of self-consciousness, that's probably where you would find that the most.
Yeah, I mean, but how would you measure it, you know, in a brain level when it happens so randomly?
Exactly. It's very tricky. And again, I think we will go into that a tiny bit. It will be quite technical, but we'll try to keep it as short as possible because it is important in this whole conversation about what the flow state is. But for now, I think we should go to a more recognizable domain or dimension of the flow, which is that the transformation of time changes. And this is something I think we have all felt happening to us at some point in our lives.
Yeah, you kind of lose track of time. It didn't happen to me when I was running because, I don't know, when you run, it's such a short period of, you know, flow state. But sometimes when I'm just like, you know, reading even, and then, I don't know, I don't have my phone or anything close by, and then I, you know, I just check it and like, oh my God, 3 hours passed or four, and I was just, you know, reading. So you don't really pay attention to anything else. Like, time don't exist for you.
Yeah, it's a very strange thing. I think the closest that I come to this on a sort of, I won't say daily basis, but it's, you know, when you're driving and you sort of wake up and you go, look, how many minutes have passed since I last realized I was driving?
Yeah.
And you can't really tell what happened to you. You can't really tell what you were thinking about, but you know time has passed, but not how much. And I think it's the closest I come to being an Olympic athlete. to you know, understand this transformation of time. And yeah, like I said, it's something that I think many people have experienced. But even athletes that do something, you know, thousands upon thousands of times a day, get this feeling that what they're doing is stretched out over time or happening faster, because it's not definitely faster, is it?
Yeah.
It can also be the slowing of time.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it never really happened. I'm sure it happened when I was in this flow state running, but I don't, it's such a short period of time that I don't feel it faster or shorter. I just feel it as it is. But it's good because, like, whenever I run and, I don't know, I'm getting tired, you know, not feeling time kind of helps you lose this tiredness and then, you know, all the pain and lactic that comes with a 400 meter.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think for runners as well, you kind of know the time because of where you are on the track, don't you? You've run that 400 meters so many times. But, for example, a baseballer, who is, you know, a pitch is being thrown at, that has the sort of time slot of blinking. You know, it happens so fast.
Yeah.
And nevertheless, they are able to not only hit it, but also aim, decide what they're going to do with it. I think this is, I don't know if it actually counts as flow state, but it definitely something is happening there in the transformation of time, of it at least feeling like it's slowing down.
Yeah.
And that shows how, you know, different dimensions can happen in different sports, obviously, as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's interesting that you don't necessarily need all, like, the nine dimensions to be in a flow state.
Exactly, and that's important to mention, you know. It you can have parts or
yeah,
certain dimensions you feel a bit more, or some you don't at all.
Yeah.
This happens too.
Yeah, so we have the last dimension, Lars.
Right, yes.
Do you want to describe it to us,
please? Of course, I'd love to. It's the autotelic experience. And this is what I would say is the end result of mm-hmm. being in a flow. A feeling that is all about doing something just for the sake of doing it.
Yeah.
I hope I described that correctly. There's no expectation of a future reward or a benefit. It's all about doing that because you like doing it.
Yeah. The book also mentions it as, like, you know, making of meaning, because, like, every body is kind of purpose driven in general, and, you know, by nature. So, like, it's like you have a purpose finally, and then you're just, you know, happy to do it, and you just, you know, getting crazy about it, that you have a purpose finally.
Yes,
and just,
you can't stop.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I think what's interesting about this is that these dimensions were described by Chicky in his multiple books, and again, they were not necessarily focused on athletes, but a study in Australia in the 90s was done, and they used these dimensions and focused on, you know, which ones were more common in athletes mm-hmm. and which one weren't. And this one, the autotelic experience of flow, was by far the most mm-hmm. mentioned by athletes. 96% in fact of the athletes in that research mentioned this.
Yeah.
So I think this love of the game, we might call it,
yeah.
isn't it? Love for the game is perhaps the most important of all,
yeah.
when it comes to,
I mean, if it doesn't have a personal meaning, then why would you do it with such motivation and input?
That's a very nice motivational
yeah.
quote that we just got in there. You know, it's true for everyone, and I you know, most people could probably relate to that,
yeah.
can't they?
Yeah, so flow state, and, you know, measuring it, we kind of mentioned that it's difficult to measure it in general, and most studies use, like, questionnaires with the athletes and personal experiences. But Lars, do you have anything, any brainy stuff that could be interesting? I mean, you know, it's still in baby shoes, the research, because it's so difficult to measure, but
yes,
any
absolutely.
Physiological type?
Well, actually, it's one of the things where the difference between the flow state in our daily life and in athletes becomes very, very clear. One of the first, and still one of the mainly used measurement techniques of measurement of flow is what's called the experiment sampling method, and Chicky describes it in his paper in 92. And what it basically is it requires individuals to do a very short questionnaire at random times. So what they give you is a sort of beeper, very 90s. They give you a beeper and they let you wear that for, let's say, a week. It's
mm-hmm.
usually a week, a predetermined period of time. And when it gives a signal, that's when you have to respond to this questionnaire. But obviously, this is very, very real life, daily life based, and for athletes, completely useless. So to try and make that work for athletes, they come up with a scale, and it's a 36 or 45 item scale. I won't go into it too deep because it's, you know, it's not what we're here for, but it's based on these nine dimensions that
mm-hmm.
we just described, and it's been tested as well with about 800 athletes, young and old, in two studies. With good results, kind of good results, mm-hmm. but, and I think this is the most important part of the research, is that part of the attraction of the flow state, part of the mysticity, the mystique around the flow state, is that it cannot be fully captured. And actually, Chiki mentions this as well, and he says he actually warns us to be cautious with putting too much weight on empirical measures of flow. In fact, he states that flow is the balance of challenges and skill, and you can't say that flow is a score of X on a flow questionnaire. Yeah. If we do that, we have lost what flow state is.
Yeah, I mean, exactly, because we just mentioned you don't necessarily need all the nine dimensions, so it's so individual that you can't really generalize it, can you?
Absolutely, and it, of course, it's something that, especially in sports science, happens a lot. You know, you try to find things about a sporting performance you can measure, but if you go too precise or too deep or too fundamental in your measurement technique, you might lose if it, you know, does it actually benefit the sporting performance?
Yeah.
You know, a good example of that would be, you know, I can measure heart rate all the time, but not the person with the best heart rate wins the race,
yeah.
or the highest heart rate or whatever. You know, you have to really be careful not to go too deep, because any sporting performance is a holistic experience.
I actually wanted to ask you whether there are any empirical evidence or, you know, measurement that of what kind of physiological symptoms flow state might have, you know, like increased heart rate, or, you know, athletes sweating more, or, you know, I don't know, maybe your heart rate even slows down if it's unconscious or stuff like that.
Yeah, this is obviously very hard to measure, because as an athlete especially, you don't want to be running around with any equipment that is not necessary. Not necessary. But what we do find, especially in neurophysiology, is that the frontal lobe is less active. Now, the frontal lobe is responsible for planning, self-consciousness, the non-automatic things, I might say. And you see that this is less active, which gives a sort of insight in the automaticity that the flow state brings.
Yeah.
And they did this later with fMRI studies, and this was actually not really confirmed by that study, but that was mainly because the prefrontal areas were quite active.
Yeah.
Now, there is some reason for that. The frontal areas are related to self-thinking, and as we described, it's some sort of a, well, we described it as loss of self-consciousness, didn't we? So the self-thinking decreases, which is seen in this research. But the prefrontal areas are more active. And this is actually backed up by a rather cool study on tightrope performance, which is always nice.
Yeah.
You know, when you try to read a tough topic and all of a sudden they bring out a tightrope performer. And they actually saw that during the flow state, anxiety dropped,
mm-hmm.
and the frontal lobe activity dropped as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, as a, you know, again, it's very early on, and but I think that's a very good finding, and it shows that being too focused on something might not always be the best.
Yeah,
it can really throw you off. And Another important thing is I'm gonna call it the nucleus. It's a nucleus in the pons. It's got a tough name. It's the locus coeruleus noradrenaline, or epinephrine if you're from the States. It's in the brainstem, and it's responsible for noradrenaline release in the brain. And this regulates decisions usually, and especially decisions regarding task engagement versus disengagement. And you can see that it's very stimulus invoked. So what we mean by that is that you have stuff happening around you in your environment, or a certain task that you need to perform, and that's when this nucleus becomes active and, mm. and regulates the noradrenaline. And it's also been shown to correlate with stuff that we tend to correlate with flow states, stuff like pupil dilation, arousal.
Again, Lars forgot to explain. Don't worry, I'll make him pay for that. Arousal is the physiological and psychological state of being awoken and or excited. It is important in regulating consciousness, attention, alertness, and information processing.
And so you see that there is bits here and there on what it is that the flow, you know, yeah. what the flow state is, but it's very hard to pinpoint where it happens in the brain. Again, this could be because of the many dimensions to it.
Yeah, I mean, it's and like, how would you measure it? Like, you know, putting someone in an fMRI, you cannot really trigger a flow state. Maybe I was thinking maybe you could do it like asking the person to visualize the act, like especially an athlete, that
exactly,
could help, but
exactly.
that doesn't necessarily mean that you get into the state anyway.
And you immediately get in trouble with the sort of external validity of studies
yeah.
like that. How
yeah.
relatable is it to real life? So it's a tricky subject. And I think if you take anything away from this podcast, please let it be that we don't know the answers either.
Yeah.
You know, that's what science is. We're trying to figure it out, but we don't know. Nevertheless, you know, we're getting closer and closer.
Trying at least.
We're trying so hard, so hard.
And now, in accordance with tradition, I declare the games of the Charity Olympia closed and call on the youth of the world to assemble 4 years from now in Rio de Janeiro to celebrate the games of the Charity Olympia. Thank you.
Right, so we just listened to the podcast, Esther. What did you think?
I think it was okay. I think I wasn't as nervous towards the end as in the beginning, and I think it went very smooth and very well altogether. I did enjoy the conversation.
I agree. I thought it was very, like, you could hear I was quite nervous in the beginning, and it got better towards the end. I feel like we will get more natural, like.
Yeah, it comes with practice, I guess, but you know. This is our first podcast in English. So yeah, I think we did very well comparing to that.
Yeah. Did you also notice that I have like a stopping word?
No, I only noticed that I do say a lot that, you know,
well,
I do
yeah,
say that a lot.
I say that a lot as well. And I say a lot of absolutely.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
That's
true.
That's
true.
I suppose it's just because I agree with you so much, but. Well, people heard it now anyway, so if they want to hear it, they can listen back to it.
Yeah, I mean, they can make a drinking game out of it, you know.
That's
you know,
yeah, that's a great idea. Right, so what so let me explain kind of what we're doing here, because it's a bit of a different setting than what we just had. It's Sunday morning, and we decided that it was kind of a weird ending to the podcast, so we thought we might have like a little talk on what we thought of it, and maybe talk about the book a bit more as well. I do have to say, some of my neighbors are doing something in the garden, and I don't know what, but it's a massive noise whenever it happens, so that might come through, and I do apologize.
I cannot hear that though.
No, I don't think. Well, he's doing something. Well, that's not important. The book, we touched on the book quite a bit, but for the people listening, do you think they should read it, or do you think that listening to our podcast is enough?
I mean, of course, you're super smart, and I would say definitely listen to our podcast anyways, but I do recommend the book because it's very interesting to read. It's, you know, it's kind of like an easy language to understand. So it's not super scientific, and it's not like very technical or detailed. So it's, you know, it's, I think it's written for everybody. Even if you are in the field, like you study psychology or you are already a psychologist, there are a lot of like good take home messages, even then. But if you're not, you know, familiar with the field at all, it's still a very informative reading. So I would definitely recommend to just go on and have a try on the book as well.
Right, Terry, very nice. And these take-home messages, can you give us one?
Say again?
These take-home messages, can you give us one, possibly?
The take-home message? Yeah, I'll try. So my take-home message, you know, from the whole podcast and, you know, based on the book, just would be just do something that means, you know, meaning is meaningful to you, that makes you happy, makes you joyful, and it's not, it doesn't have any pressure on you, you know, it's like a hobby technically.
I think that's a great one. I think that might be the best take home message ever in this podcast.
I'm flattered.
So do you think we should do this more often? Do you think we should do more podcasts?
Oh, yes, please. I think we do have a lot of interesting topics that, you know, in common that we both really want to discover and explore more in depth. And I do love these conversations. So, yeah, definitely. Let's make a podcast out of it.
Yeah, I fully agree. And I think that this podcast was also, it started as a uni project. And
yeah.
I think that shone through a couple of times. And I think in future podcasts, we can make it a bit more relax possibly and leave out the hardcore sciencey stuff with, you know, maybe a bit more but yeah, I'm up for it. Let's do it. So
yeah, let's
if
do it.
People listening think that we should do that too, and maybe what we should do them about, just let us know. Do we have like an email address or something? Do we have something? Twitter account, Instagram, do we do?
We can make an Instagram account or a Twitter account. If you want, we can also have a website.
Oh, here we go. Now, you know what? What we'll do is we'll put like our uni account somewhere, our uni email somewhere. And for those few out there that are actually going to say something, we really appreciate it if you do.
Yeah, we do. And then in case we actually do the podcast, you know, it's worth to subscribe, give us a like, you know, 5-star rating, any positive comments. We are always happy for that.
Yeah, like a little feedback is fine as well. You know, don't be too rude. We're still in the beginning of this. I know this because I just hold up my thumbs like an idiot.
but they're anyway, not going to know that.
No, people will not know that. That's why I mention it. But yeah, so please do that. And hopefully we'll see you soon or hear you soon or hear from you soon.
Yeah, and also topic recommendations are always welcome too.
That's a great idea. That's a great idea. Right, well, thank you so much for listening. Thank you, Esther.
Thank you, Lars. And hopefully see you soon. And hopefully you guys come back and listen to us more in the future.
I would.
Yeah, me too. I call you. Nice.
Three of the songs you heard in this podcast were from different Olympic games. See if you can guess from which Olympics they were. You won't win anything, but it could be fun. If you have the answer or anything else you want us to know, reach out to us at lvanlover7@alumnes.ub.edu.